And I say the same thing with respect to the arms. You know, we are hearing from Melanie Joly, the foreign minister, that Canada has, quote unquote, paused the issuance of new permits for military equipment to be exported to Israel. But under questioning, she revealed that they haven't revoked permits that were issued prior to January 8th. So presumably military equipment continues to be sent over under those permits. And a pause is not the same thing as a legal prohibition.
So I'm going to jump in there. So going through these demands for action, number one is impose, you're asking that the demanding that the Canadian government impose a complete ban on the sale and the delivery of arms and other military equipment to Israel. What is the Canadian government providing to Israel in the way of arms and other military equipment? What's the total value?
Faisal, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that in the first 3 months, it was in the range after October 7th of $28 million. There was a very sharp increase over recent history. So not only did they not stop it, but there was a significant increase in terms of the monetary value of the equipment. And another problem we have here is that the precise nature of the equipment that's being sent, it's all very opaque and unclear. So the government keeps referring to non-lethal military equipment. No one really knows what that means.
So the Canadian government says it's only providing non-lethal military equipment to Israel. That's what it's saying?
I believe what it was saying was that it was not issuing permits for lethal military equipment up until January 8th. So it was only allowing up to January 8th permits for non-lethal military equipment. But there's been some excellent work done by the Maple about this. And, you know, let's take, for example, an example that I like to give is an armored personnel carrier. Okay, let's suppose an armored and it doesn't have machine guns or cannons mounted on it. Well, if the armored personnel carrier is in itself not killing Palestinians, but it's delivering combat soldiers into the heart of Gaza, enabling them to penetrate deep into Gaza when they otherwise wouldn't be able to do that if they weren't in an armored personnel carrier, and then they proceed to commit war crimes, as many of them are. Well, effectively, this piece of military equipment is being used for lethal purposes, even though in and of itself it may not be killing Palestinians. So there's a lot of obfuscation here. There's a lot of there's a great lack of clarity, which I fear the government is exploiting to give to Israel military equipment, which does in fact facilitate in some way the killing of Palestinians.
Now, item two here is impose a complete ban on the importation into Canada of arms and other military equipment made in Israel. So what is Canada importing from Israel in the way of arms and ammunition that supports Israel's arms industry?
We are taking issue with Canada supporting Israel's arms industry by purchasing missiles to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. And it's worth noting that the arms industry in Israel is very closely aligned with the state, essentially state-owned. And so this is another way in which Canadian cooperation, although purchasing missiles doesn't necessarily, those aren't missiles that are killing Palestinians, but it's part of the support that Canada gives to Israel's military industrial complex that is the killing machine in Gaza.
What sorts of missiles does Canada import from Israel?
I don't know the details about that. There's a parallel litigation that is underway that was launched a couple of weeks ago that challenges this trade relationship directly. Our legal team is watching that litigation closely, and it's related but not identical to what we are doing.
I can just add a little insight into the nature of the missiles. And I'm quoting here the Maple, which again has done excellent reporting on this issue. According to the Maple, Defense News confirmed early this month that the missile system of choice for Canada would be the Spike LR2. They are multi-purpose fire and forget guided munitions that can be man-launched or adapted to be fired from vehicles. And apparently they are capable of breaching up to 20 centimeters of reinforced concrete and can cause immense and lethal damage to structural targets. So, you know, these, even though it would be Canada buying them, Canada is basically financing by purchasing these from an Israeli manufacturer of these items. It's financing the development of these very items, making it profitable for them to produce more of them And at the end of the day, indirectly facilitating the oppression of Palestinians by enriching the Israeli military-industrial complex.
And what on earth does Canada need missiles of that sort that can penetrate concrete, that they can fire and forget them? Why does Canada need these?
I think that's an excellent question. I certainly don't know the answer.
And then, you know, so number three is suspend Canada's military cooperation with Israel, including, but not limited to, the Canada-Israel Strategic Partnership. What is that, the Canada-Israel Strategic Partnership, that you want the Canadian government to terminate?
Well, like all things, David, in the security sphere, it's really hard to know what exactly that means. I suspect that it includes intelligence sharing. So, for example, according to ISTP Canada, there is a cybersecurity element to this. So, you know, it would not only be intelligence sharing, but intelligence gathering, surveillance. So I would also imagine that there's an element of military training, security training going on. If you want to get the details of this, by the way, you can, to the extent they're being published at all, there is a relatively brief statement about the substance of the Canada-Israel Strategic Partnership on the Global Affairs Canada website.
Now, here in your letter as well, this is not itemized in your demands on the last page, but you talk about the Canadian Special Forces in Israel. Canada has Special Forces, JFT, that's Joint Force Task. What is that, Joint Task Force 2, personnel in Israel?
Yeah, we there's information that they're there. It's not clear. I don't know if Dimitri knows better than I, but it seems that it's not clear what they're exactly doing, but there was confirmation that they're on the ground.
Huh, can you put a number to that? Any idea how many actual Canadian military personnel belonging to the Canadian Special Forces, JFT2 Force, are inside Israel? And you can imagine, this is just the sort of thing Canadian Special Forces would love to do, working with their good friends, counterparts in Israel, right, fighting terrorism. And
they've presumably done training together. They've done exercises. So it's, you know, this is a chance. This Gaza is becoming a petri dish for experimentation, whether it's new weapons, or perhaps whether it's new training and new collaboration. I mean, I don't know if Canadian forces are in any sort of combat role or anywhere close to any kind of combat role. That would be a heinous thing to discover. But even them being there and offering any kind of support, even symbolic solidarity, is itself offensive to Canada's legal obligations.
Now, of course, there are young Canadians serving in the Israeli Defense Forces, wearing boots, Israeli boots, Canadians in Israeli boots. And item 7 here in your demand for action, enforce the Foreign Enlistment Act by prosecuting individuals and organizations recruiting Canadians for engagements with Israel's armed forces. Talk about that. I mean, that's surprising, right? If Canadians were going abroad, Russian Canadians going abroad, fighting along with the Russians in Ukraine, boy, we'd hear about that. Or pick any number of other examples. I suppose the Canadian government would support the right of Canadian Ukrainians to go to Ukraine and fight the Russians. That might be a different story.
Well, as you know, David, we've incorporated into Canadian domestic law the war crimes provisions of the Rome Statute, and also various provisions relating to crimes against humanity and war crimes in the Geneva Convention. So whether prosecutions under these provisions would occur is in the discretion of the Attorney General. I would suggest that a mere threat on the part of the Attorney General of Canada to employ these provisions against any Canadian citizen who serves in the Israeli military in the course of this genocide would be sufficient to deter a great many Canadian Israelis from even contemplating service in the Israeli military. I doubt that they would actually have to even pursue prosecutions in any large number in order to effect deterrence. And I think that's exactly what happened in the case of the Ukraine war. The mere threat that the Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland made to use these provisions, I'm not aware of a single, I mean, I'm not saying there aren't any, but I have not seen a single report of any Russian Canadian fighting on the side of Russia in the course of this war. I've seen multiple reports of Canadian Israelis fighting in Gaza with the IDF in the course of this genocide. And there's been no determination by any international tribunal that it is plausible that Russia is committing genocide in Ukraine.
And are there Israeli organizations, Israeli IDF-associated entities actually doing recruiting in Canada?
Well, there's Canadian, organization. For example, in 2005, two of Canada's richest people, Jerry Schwartz and Heather Reisman, founded the Hesig Foundation, which is a charity that pays for tuition and living expenses for what they call lone soldiers. That's these young people from Canada who go to Israel to join the military. And if they want to stay in Israel to go to school afterwards, the Hesig Foundation will pay their tuition. And they estimate that somewhere around 6,000 lone soldiers serve in the IDF each year.
From all nationalities.
Yeah, from around the world. And it's for this reason that after the Gaza incursion began, activists began to target the most visible sign of Heather Reisman's wealth and power, being Indigo Bookstore. And we've seen how these protests have been maligned and the protesters have been smeared and they've been criminalized at every level, right down to the nature of their arrests by the police, who decided to throw the book at them and humiliate them by raiding their homes, treating them like common criminals, worse, treating them like terrorists, actually. Activists who are seeking to bring attention to the fact that this very wealthy individual who owns a recognizable Canadian company is supporting and funding the travel of Canadians to go fight in the Israeli military. But the Canadian public does not get accurate reporting on this from the media. And the authorities are actually doing Israel's work for it by suppressing this information and tarring the activists with the all too common anti-Semitism smear.
And item six in your demand for action, calling on the Canadian government to enforce the policy of the Canada Revenue Agency by eliminating charitable status for all Canadian organizations that contribute funds directly or indirectly to benefit Israel's armed forces. So there are Canadian organizations that are charitable under the Canada Revenue Agency. They've enjoyed charitable status, and they're helping out the IDF.
I've seen charities that fundraise for medical assistance for the Israeli Red Cross, equivalent of the Red Cross, those sorts of things, which are peripheral to direct military activity. It's difficult to get detailed information about this sort of thing, but I've done a little bit of research, and there are charities that have been found to actually be in breach of the terms of their operation. And even in those cases, they're given a second and third chance. Whereas when you see Muslim charities that for whom there's any mere accusation or even hint of association with potential for association with foreign terrorism, will have their charitable status pulled immediately. And so there's been an attempt to expose this differential treatment. This was happening before October 7th. I published a piece last year precisely about the targeting of Muslim charities, and I had been working on a comparative piece looking at the treatment of Muslim charities in comparison to other religious charities, which included some Christian charities and some Jewish charities. And among those Jewish charities were charities that appeared to be supporting the Israeli military.
Now, item four in your demand for action, moving from Gaza to the West Bank, as everybody's talking about Gaza, while these huge crimes are taking place, grievous breaches of international humanitarian law on the West Bank have been since 1967. But item four, you're calling on the Canadian government to ban the importation into Canada of all products made in Israel's illegal West Bank settlements. The Canadian government considers West Bank settlements to be illegal, a breach under the Fourth Geneva Convention and under Canada's own Geneva Conventions Act. And yet Canada welcomes Israeli settlement, West Bank settlement products into Canada. It extends favorable tariff treatments to them. It's astonishing. And so this letter is calling on the government to completely ban the importation of settlement products. Dmitry?
Yes, again, to the extent that the government is allowing those products to be imported into Canada, and on top of that, with preferential tariff treatment, it is making Israel's breaches of international law more profitable. And ultimately, that accrues to the benefit of the state of Israel, economically speaking, and that enhances its ability to use military force and other means to oppress the Palestinian people. And of course, the settlements themselves are a form of oppression. Not only are they, generating additional tax revenue for the Israeli government, and this is an absolute bar or impediment, a practical impediment to the creation of a Palestinian state, these settlements, which the Canadian government has claimed over and over again to support. That in turn creates tremendous tension between the people of Palestine and the Israeli regime that is oppressing them. Ultimately, that leads to military conflict. All of these things are intertwined, and I think that that's one of the things we're going to be exploring in this litigation, is that we really can't compartmentalize, we ought not to attempt to compartmentalize the suffering of the people of Gaza from that of other Palestinians living under occupation. This is one regime of apartheid and now genocide that's being waged against them all. And I just came from the West Bank and I visited the Jenin and Tul Karm refugee camps. And in my opinion as a lawyer, based on what I saw, the project of genocide extends to the West Bank and particularly the refugee camps. It's simply being conducted at this point in time at a lower level of intensity.
And then there are these other items. They're almost ancillary, like imposing economic and travel sanctions on Benjamin Netanyahu and all officers in the Israeli armed forces. I mean, I can imagine this happening in another universe, but not our universe, not the dimension we inhabit here on the planet. It seems like it would never happen, or recall Canada's ambassador to Israel.
True, but Canada has committed to sanctioning extremist West Bank settlers. That's a start. There's no evidence that anything has been done to that end, but that would be something that could happen in this universe. We've seen it from the United States in a very modest way, but that's something to push. But you're right. The severing of diplomatic relations with Israel in the way that Canada did, the kind of treatment that Canada and other Western countries put Russia to after its grave breaches of international law and occupation of Ukraine, are simply not matched here. And there's no real reason. There's no principled reason. And it's simply about, well, Israel's our friend, Israel's our close ally. And there hasn't yet been reason to revisit that. I think in the longer term, that relationship is going to be severely destabilized when you see the level of protest and the level of anger that young people especially are showing towards those in power. I think there's a generational shift. Unfortunately, it's going to come too slowly to be of any immediate benefit.
But cutting to a certain kind of chase, what really strikes me is that international law kind of stands for nothing. It isn't worth the paper it's written on. The laws are not dismantled. They're simply not enforced. So Canada is obliged under Article 1 of the Fourth Geneva Convention and Canada's own Geneva Conventions Act to respect and ensure respect for the convention in all circumstances. And by all accounts, Israel has systematically and grievously, outrageously violated international, the UN Charter, the Fourth Geneva Convention in Gaza. It's widely regarded as engaging in forcible starvation, for heaven's sake, and possibly genocide. These are the most grievous of crimes. They're crimes against humanity. And Canada is obliged to uphold Article 1 of Geneva 4, Article 1 of the Genocide Convention. It's obliged to abide by Article 25 of the UN Charter, which obliges it to abide by UN Security Council resolutions like 2334, which called on states to differentiate between Israel proper and occupied territories. Canada doesn't do any of that. Quite the opposite. So it's like this war on Gaza is demonstrating to the world, Israel is demonstrating to the world, that international law really means nothing. So how do you confront this? Is this something that rattles around in your head? I'm sure it does. Dmitry?
Well, that's precisely why this litigation and other initiatives in the domestic courts of states that are part of the Genocide Convention matter so much, because the only enforcement mechanism of the decisions of the International Court of Justice at the international level is the UN Security Council. As we've seen, the United States is hell-bent on blocking any action by the UN Security Council to enforce the decision of the ICJ. I mean, they haven't even talked about sanctioning Israel. They haven't even talked to the UN Security Council of, you know, prosecuting Israel or leaders of Israel, military and political, for war crimes. All they're talking about is a ceasefire, a cessation of violence, and, you know, the introduction of massive and necessary humanitarian aid into Gaza, and they can't even do that. So it's, we need, as a result of that fundamental flaw in the structure of international legal enforcement, to pursue whatever initiatives we can in the domestic courts. And we saw recently that this has been successful in the Netherlands, where the domestic courts, the Supreme Court of the Netherlands, ordered, as I'm sure you know, David, in the Netherlands, the government of the Netherlands to stop delivering the parts for F-35s to Israel.
Yeah, this was an appeals court. It wasn't the High Court, but it was a Dutch appeals court.
Right. And so this is the kind of action. Unfortunately, the litigation, which we talked about earlier, hasn't succeeded thus far in the United States. But even the fact that the judge, a judge of the federal district court, said it was plausible that Israel is committing genocide is of value. So we need absolutely all over the world legal initiatives to be pursued in the domestic courts in order to fill the breach, the void that's been created by the flaws of the United Nations Charter.
Yeah, I think, David, you're right to point out that international law is proving to be a very weak mechanism to restrain state power, especially where it's enabled by the most powerful states. But that's partly why we're not relying on an international law in our litigation. We have the unique opportunity in the form of the War Crimes and Crimes Against Humanity Act that Canada has, the only piece of international law, relevant international law, that Canada has actually incorporated into domestic law is that. And so we're going under Canadian law. We're using the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which indirectly incorporates a lot of international legal standards in that it's a conventional liberal rights instrument that protects things like the right to life and security of the person. And so we're relying on those legal protections, which are legally binding and operate to constrain the Canadian government. You may know that in 2010, the Supreme Court of Canada heard an appeal by the Canadian government against a decision of the Federal Court of Appeal that had ordered the Canadian government to request that the U.S. return Omar Khadr from Guantanamo Bay. And the Prime Minister Harper at the time decided to appeal that case, asking the Supreme Court to reverse. And the court refused to reverse on the substance, but did agree that it wasn't really the court's place to tell the government what to do. And so instead, the court upheld the charter violation, said that the government has breached Omar Khadr's charter rights, and then left it to the government to decide what would be the best course of action to comply with the charter. And we think that that's, as modest as that is, it's a powerful tool to get a court to declare that the government is failing in its charter obligations to a Canadian citizen anywhere in the world. And then it's on the government as a political matter to do the right thing. I don't know how confident we are that if we got a favorable decision from a court that the government would do the right thing, but that's where we're starting.
And as far as the crimes against Canada's Crimes Against Humanity and War Crimes Act, if I'm not mistaken, it's entirely up to the Attorney General whether or not to enforce it. Same as the Canada's Geneva Conventions Act. Canada is obliged to, in theory, to uphold and enforce these legal instruments, domestic legal instruments, but it's entirely up to the Attorney General to do it, and no court will tell the Attorney General, you've got to do it. And the Attorney General, you know, routinely doesn't.
I wouldn't rule out the possibility that a court would order the Attorney General to do it, but it would be very difficult, I think, to persuade a court to do that. And it may be necessary at some point in the reasonably near future for that particular issue to be taken on in the domestic courts of Canada, because I think we can't leave any stone unturned. We have an obligation to pursue all avenues of lawful relief for the Palestinian people. And if the Attorney General of Canada is absolutely determined to leave those, cast those legal provisions by the wayside, despite the evidence of genocide, then it's incumbent upon us as citizens of conscience to pursue all avenues of relief.
So you've given the government until April 3rd to respond. You've given the Right Honorable Justin Trudeau and Melanie Joly, his foreign minister, and a few others, until April 3rd to respond to your demand for action. And it would be quite astonishing if they wrote you back and said, you know, the Messrs. Lascaris and Baba, we shall act. We'll do the right thing. Thank you for your letter. I mean, I'm sure they won't. So what's the next step? How does that play out?
Well, I think the likely scenario at this stage, we've got a large and growing legal team who are refining the legal strategy that we're going to pursue. I think we have a pretty good plan in place already, but I think that this is likely to be pursued in Ontario. Our clients are there, and you know, most of the lawyers on this legal team are there. Of course, the capital of the country is there, so I think we're likely to see litigation in the province of Ontario. It will be pursued probably in the Superior Court of Justice, and once we launch, that will be initiated by the filing of a pleading, what we lawyers call an originating pleading. And at that point, the government will have a limited period within which to respond. And it may, in this particular case, may very well respond by bringing a motion similar to the one that you saw in the United States litigation, where effectively the Biden administration argued that the court didn't have the jurisdiction to grant the relief that was being requested. So we anticipate the government's going to throw everything in the kitchen, you know, but the kitchen sink and then some at this particular litigation. The stakes are very high. So we may see, you know, any number of motions being brought very early on in litigation to avoid a final determination on the merits. Hopefully the government won't do that. Hopefully the government will either fulfill the demand before we file litigation or promptly act responsibly the moment it realizes that we mean business. I don't think anybody would be happier than our clients and the legal team if that were to transpire. But we're prepared for them to launch a broad raging legal war against this case.
Dimitri Lascaris is a private attorney, journalist, and activist. Faisal Baba is an attorney with the Legal Center for Palestine. Read more about their demand letter to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and other senior Canadian leaders at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry, or also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your outstanding instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Homelessness is a lot like musical chairs. Except not with chairs.
When the music stops, more than a quarter of a million Canadians, many of them children, don't have a home.
But if we act right now with urgency, we can fix it.
Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca.
Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
You're listening